dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. What do armed resistance against U.S.-sponsored elections in occupied Iraq, the kidnapping of the elected president of Haiti by U.S. commandos, and homelessness in New York City have to do with one another? They are part of what one of our speakers tonight calls the military monetary system. To begin the program, I'd like to read you an article that was published January 27th in Alternet. It's called "Of Oil and Elections," written by Antonia Juhaj. She writes, "Remember when we used to talk about how the war in Iraq was about oil? Remember the banners that read, 'No blood for oil'? Oil has fallen out of the discussion lately, but it's time to bring it back in light of the Iraqi elections scheduled for this Sunday, that is, today. To refresh our collective memory, President Bush himself declared just before the invasion of Iraq that, quote, 'Our jobs, our way of life, our own freedom, and the freedom of friendly countries around the world would all suffer if control of the world's great oil reserves fell into the hands of Saddam Hussein,' close quote." This was Bush Sr. speaking in August 1990, on the eve of the first Persian Gulf War. More precise are the words of Chevron CEO Kenneth T. Durr, speaking in San Francisco in 1988. Quote, "Iraq possesses huge reserves of oil and gas, reserves I'd love Chevron to have access to." Close quote. After two wars and one occupation, Durr may finally get his wish. On December 22, 2004, Iraqi Finance Minister Abdel Mahdi told a handful of reporters and industry insiders at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., that Iraq wants to issue a new oil law that would open Iraq's national oil company to private foreign investment. As Mahdi explained, "So I think this is very promising to the American investors and to American enterprise, certainly to oil companies," close quote. In other words, Mahdi is proposing to privatize Iraq's oil and put it into American corporate hands. According to the finance minister, foreigners would gain access to both downstream and maybe even upstream oil investment. This means foreigners can sell Iraqi oil and own it underground, the very thing for which many argue the U.S. went to war in the first place. As Vice President Dick Cheney's Defense Policy Guidance Report explained back in 1992, "Our overall objective is to remain the predominant outside power in the Middle East region and preserve U.S. and Western access to the region's oil," close quote. While few in the American media other than Imad McKay of Interpress Service reported on or even attended Mahdi's press conference, the announcement was made with U.S. Undersecretary of State Alan Larson at Mahdi's side. It was intended to send a message, but to whom? It turns out that Abdel Mahdi is running in the January 30th elections on the ticket of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution, SCIR, the leading Shiite political party. While announcing the selling off of the resource, which provides 95% of all Iraqi revenue, may not garner Mahdi many Iraqi votes, but it will unquestionably win him tremendous support from the U.S. government and U.S. corporations. Mahdi's SCIR is far and away the front runner in the upcoming elections, particularly as it becomes increasingly less possible for Sunnis to vote because the regions where they live are spiraling into deadly chaos. If Bush were to suggest to Iraqi's interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi that elections should be called off, Mahdi and the SCIR's ultimate chances of victory will likely decline. Thus, one might argue that the Bush administration has made a deal with the SCIR, Iraq's oil, for guaranteed political power. The Americans are able to put forward such a bargain because Bush still holds the strings in Iraq. Regardless of what happens in the elections, for at least the next year during which the newly elected National Assembly writes the Constitution and Iraqis vote for a new government, the Bush administration is going to control the largest pot of money available in Iraq, the $24 billion in U.S. taxpayer money allocated for the reconstruction, the largest military, and the rules governing Iraq's economy. Both the money and the rules will in turn be overseen by U.S.-appointed auditors and inspector generals who sit in every Iraqi ministry with five-year terms and sweeping authority over contracts and regulations. However, the one thing which the administration has been unable to confer upon itself is guaranteed access to Iraqi oil. That is, until now. Based on all reports from both U.S. military and Iraqi officials, the elections this Sunday could be a bloodbath for Iraqis and American troops alike. They are also certain to be far from representative. Democratic elections simply cannot be held under these conditions, nor conditions in which the U.S. government and its corporations exercise such dominant economic and political control. The Bush administration cannot be permitted to declare a war for, quote, Iraqi freedom and respond with an economic invasion that turns Iraq into a U.S. corporate grab bag. No blood for oil rings as true today as it did 15 years ago. That article, Of Oil and Elections, by Antonia Juhasz, from the January 27th Alternet. Antonia Juhasz is a San Francisco-based scholar working on a book about the economic invasion of Iraq. Next, to Haiti. Stan Goff is a former U.S. Army Special Forces sergeant and the author of Hideous Dream, a book about U.S. intervention in Haiti, where he served as part of an American occupation force in 1994. He spoke last December in Newark, New Jersey, at a meeting of the community group People's Organization for Progress.
I was looking at the minutes over here, and I was really happy to see that somebody had a little moment of silence for John Brown. And I'm real happy to be here with an organization that privileges history in its process, because history is important for us. We can't understand what's going on around us right now unless we understand that we're part of a process of history and know where we came from. And John Brown's real important to me because in the history of the United States, there's not a hell of a lot of white guys that I can look to as role models, you know what I'm saying? So, who was supposed to be with John Brown on the raid on Harper's Ferry that couldn't come? Harriet Tubman. But she had an epileptic seizure and couldn't make it from a head injury that she had sustained as a young woman when she stood in front of a piece of metal that was thrown at a slave as he was running away and got hit in the head. She suffered from epileptic seizures the rest of her life from that. She was going to be there in combat with John Brown at the same time. And she was spared by an epileptic seizure then and proceeded to become the first and only woman to ever lead regular Army troops in combat. She didn't just run the Underground Railroad. She led troops in combat. She made over 100 forays behind enemy lines, you know. So, I mean, and as far as I'm concerned, you know, I need John Brown so that I can say, you know, I don't have a genetic defect. But Harriet Tubman's part of my lineage, too. She's part of all of our lineage. Yes. There's everything in American history is not about all the people that are privileged in the American history that we hear in our history books. You know, about I just took off from Washington, D.C., the capital of the United States. It's named after a slave owner. You know, this is someone who whipped and raped his slaves. You see what I'm saying? And that's who the capital of our nation is named after. But it ain't all bad, because we do have Harriet Tubman. We do have, there's some stuff back there we can be proud about. And we can all of us claim that as part of our lineage, because my liberation is wrapped up in everybody else's liberation, you know? One of the reasons I bring that up is because a lot of people don't understand how connected the history of Haiti is to the United States. The history of Haiti and the history of the United States is also the history of the African diaspora. All that stuff is connected. And does anybody here from Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, Tennessee? Really? Y'all were part of the Louisiana Purchase. You know why? You know? Do you know how Thomas Jefferson managed to buy that much land that cheap from Napoleon?
Tell them about it.
Because Napoleon needed money to go back and fight the British. You know why? Because he just got his ass kicked in Haiti. He was just defeated in Haiti. In 1804, January 1st, Haiti won its independence. Haiti was the first modern black nation in history anywhere. Haiti was the first nation to win its independence, not from a revolution, but from a slave revolution. Okay? Haiti was the second independent nation in this hemisphere. Simón Bolívar took his inspiration from Toussaint Louverture and from the guy that they don't want to talk about, because he's the guy that really took the thing all the way, was Jean-Jacques Dessalines. Okay? Toussaint Louverture was fighting for Haiti to become the black province of France. Dessalines, when Toussaint Louverture was tricked into captivity and taken back to die in a stinking cell in France, it was Jean-Jacques Dessalines that stripped the white out of the French tricolor and made the Haitian flag the blue and red flag they have right now. And he said, we're done with white people. He said, we're done with white people, and we're taking this all the way. And he took it to independence. And Haiti's been punished for 200 years ever since then for that. And the reason they were punished initially, and the reason they're still being punished right now, is because Henri Christophe, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, Rigaud, Toussaint Louverture, Auger, black people, many of them, Christophe, Dessalines, and Toussaint Louverture were former slaves, had just, by turns, over a period of 9 years, defeated the three most powerful imperial nations in the world. Spain fought with them, turned around and defeated them. England fought with them, turned around and defeated them. France fought with them, turned around and defeated them. These were slaves that defeated, out-administered, out-generaled, and out-organized the three most powerful European colonial master nations in the world, and in doing so, shattered the myth of white supremacy. Now, when you do that, and you're surrounded by economies whose capital accumulation is fundamentally based on slave labor, you create a little bit of a stir, which is what happened. And it created a stir in the South, all through the Caribbean, all through South America, and all through the United States, and we don't hear about this in the history books either, slave rebellions, different kinds of slave rebellions started to break out. There was no latent fear that was more powerful among white Southerners than this latent terror of slave rebellion. And so ever since then, they've had to find some way to crush Haiti, to debilitate Haiti, to cripple and twist Haiti, so they can turn around and point to Haiti as a failed nation, as a way of proving to the rest of the world that black people are incapable of self-governance. Because if they can't make that case, then they undermine an ideology that still underwrites American society, and that's the ideology of white supremacy. That's what's important to understand about Haiti in terms of its history. What's important to understand right now is, because anytime you read about it in the newspapers, you know, first of all, the newspapers always take the side of the United States State Department and their comprador allies among the Haitian bourgeoisie. They don't know anything about the mass of people that live in Haiti. And they don't want to tell you anything about the mass of people that live in Haiti. The coup d'etat in 1991 that was organized against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the first democratically elected president of the state of Haiti, the coup that was organized against him in 1991 was organized by the Central Intelligence Agency, and the coup that was organized this year was organized by the same people. I went to the Dominican Republic this year, and I talked to a Dominican general that dropped a dime. He didn't drop a dime. He dropped a manhole cover on the U.S. Embassy down there. He told me right exactly, Constanza Military Base is where these former FRAP paramilitaries that conducted this paramilitary coup in February this year had spent the last 5 years being integrated into Dominican units. And yeah, I got to understand when I say that the Dominican military doesn't do anything that's not approved by the U.S. Embassy. They're a vassal state, okay? Nothing goes on secretly in Constanza Military Base. It goes on under the direction of the Mill Group commander at the U.S. Embassy in Santo Domingo. These coups, and you people want to talk about, well, Aristide's position on this and Aristide's position on that. Aristide's positions on everything are absolutely, utterly irrelevant. Aristide was elected in the last election by 92% of the people. Unlike some people we know. You know? So, if Aristide's wrong on one thing, then Aristide's going to be wrong on one thing. If Aristide's right on one thing, then Aristide's going to be right on one thing. The attack on Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 1991 and in 2004 were not attacks on Jean-Bertrand Aristide. They were attacks on the popular sovereignty of the Haitian people. Yeah, yeah. And that's what we have to understand. Yes. When Martin Luther King was gunned down by the United States government in 1968, that was not just an attack on Martin Luther King. That was an attack on a revolutionary democratic movement that was taking place inside the United States. That was an attack on the popular sovereignty of the black nation and the American people, because you know what he was planning that they had to stop? They'd had the march on Washington. They were about to have the poor people's march. They were about to go park a million homeless bodies on the mall in Washington, D.C. And at that point in time, at that historical conjuncture, with Vietnam falling apart and all the stuff, all the social upheaval, they could not afford for that to happen. And so they decapitated that movement, but it wasn't an attack on one man. It was an attack on every single one of us. So we have to put this in context. When we talk about the coup against Aristide, it's a coup against the Haitian masses. It's a coup against their struggle for self-determination. I hear the news always reports Haiti, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. You never see the name of the nation listed by journalists independently. You never see Haiti. It's always Haiti, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. This is part of the deal. Yes, it's the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, determined by per capita income. You know, we had an electoral coup d'etat in this country in the year 2000, and we complained for about 3 days, and then everybody went to the mall. When they had a coup d'etat in Haiti, they set things on fire. Who's the poorest nation? The people that go to the mall when their sovereignty is snatched from them and their constitution is thrown in the trash? Or the people that fall out in the street? You know, who's the poorest nation? They want to talk about Haiti, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, and they always want to talk about Haiti to elicit our pity. But I'm not here to elicit pity for Haiti. I've been there 16 times. I'm going back number 17 in January and February. And I'm not going back there for my health. You know, I am in a way. I'm going back for my mental health, you know, because it's important for me to be around that. And it's not being around Haiti, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. This is a place that's been crushed repeatedly, and it continues to rise up. The reason it's a poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere is because they haven't laid down yet. You know, there's an intifada going on in Port-au-Prince right now. every single day. They got these occupation troops from Argentina, Brazil, and Chile, and shame on the leaders of those countries for conducting a surrogate occupation for the United States. These troops are trying to contain this intifada, and they're finding that they're incapable of doing it. There is no government in Haiti right now. This fake government that was installed by the U.S. Embassy with Gerard Latour II, you know, who has many of the same sort of characteristics as Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. You know, you can find somebody to go out there and contain the masses all the time, you know. They can't do it. They can't put this thing down. Because these people just keep fighting back. They keep fighting back. I've heard people in Haiti tell me they can take away everything. I'll eat leaves if I have to. Majority of the country sleeps on a dirt floor anyway. What the hell are you going to take away from somebody that already sleeps on a dirt floor? You know? And that's, you know, Bob Dylan said it back in the 60s when they had to be, he said, if you ain't got nothing, you ain't got nothing to lose. You know? So I'm proud to be associated with Haitians, you know, because to me they're an inspiration. You know? And the last three times I've been there, I've stayed up in the Central Plateau. Takes 7 hours to walk in. Right now we've got. Does anybody here not know what a maroon is? Okay, maroons, way back in the day, in various of the slave states and slave colonies in this hemisphere, were runaway slaves. They said enough is enough, and they go up into the mountains. Far, far away where nobody can get to them and set up their own independent communities. And if anybody came in to find them, sometimes they had trouble getting back out. You know? They went up there and they learned things like self-defense. Well, we've got maroon communities up there right now because there's a period right now of post-coup repression. All these frap thugs that have just come back in are going directly for the people who are the most politically organized. And I'm very closely associated with an organization called the National Popular Party, which was in a critical alliance with the Famille Lavalas. The Famille Lavalas has had some problems based on a weak organizational structure. So in the absence of the great leader, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, they've had a tendency to fragment, okay? This is an organizational structural problem, very similar to some of the structural problems we've seen plague the Palestinian Liberation Organization over the years, okay? You got a huge horizontal organization, and all the leadership is embodied in one charismatic leader, and that can be a problem, and it's something that we need to learn about here, too. Because if you have all your social power embodied in one charismatic leader, what happens when that leader is subtracted from the equation? You know, we need to have that leadership spread out. We need redundancy. We need a deep bench. You see what I'm saying? And they didn't have that. What they had was Aristide, and again, I can be critical of Aristide at the same time that I'm going to tell you that this was an illegal and immoral coup d'etat against the Aristide government. This organization, the Famille Lavalas, basically devolved into little local groups all over the country. So, you know, you've got a group here in Newark, and you've got a group over, you know, each geographic locality developed its own little, they call them a T-Famille, a little family. Famille Lavalas means the Lavalas family. And each of the little families had its own head. And each one of these heads now in this large horizontal organization, a nationwide organization, is continually competing for the attention and favor of one great man. There's a problem. And it's become a problem now post-coup. Because even though we have this very spontaneous and courageous intifada taking place inside the cities, particularly in Port-au-Prince, there's no organizational cohesion. And so it has the potential to devolve into a kind of politicized warlordism over time. And I'm just being very straight about this. Not only because of the organizational weaknesses of Famille Lavalas after you subtract the leader from the organization, but also because there are two groups of the masses in Haiti. One is about 30% of the overall population, and one is 70%. 30% have been decanted off the land and shoved into these hellish slums inside the big cities. And this is not something that's only in Haiti. This is most of the world has this situation right now, especially the world that's been intentionally underdeveloped by imperialism. You can go to Port-au-Prince, and you can go to Lima, Peru, and you can go to South Mogadishu, and poverty smells the same in every single one of those places because it's part of the same global system. You see what I'm saying? But these folks that are put in these cities are put in a situation where they no longer have access to their basic subsistence as the 70% of the Haitian population that still lives as peasants on the land do. You can be poor with food, and it's different than being poor without food. If you've got access to a little banan, a little cassava, you know, a little pois, a little zeri, something to keep nourishing your body, and the requirement for sustaining yourself in that rural situation is collectivity and strong community, then you develop an outlook on life generally of collectivity and community and organization. Where if you put people in one of these slums, it tends to be a dog-eat-dog competition for survival, and so there's a powerful element of individualism that begins to become part of the character of people's general mentality. And so this becomes a population that over the long term, in many cases, and historically it's been shown, it's very difficult for this kind of population to be disciplined into a coherent political strategy over time. Now, this is a tough proposition in most countries where urbanization has gone past the 50% point and the majority of populations are now in the cities. But in Haiti, it's unique. Haiti's class composition now is very similar to the class composition of pre-revolutionary China, with the majority of the population still living on the land. So we don't just have this intifada that's going on. There's already, in a couple of pockets up north, been some incidents that indicate that some of these peasants have gotten themselves organized and have gotten themselves armed. And they're beginning to develop areas up there in the countryside that are now no-go areas for the Makuts and the Frappists and the attaches and the occupying forces. And the political organization, not one that's directly affiliated with what looks to be the genesis of possibly some sort of an armed struggle, but that's politically affiliated with a popular base that is in the countryside, is this National Popular Party. And the National Popular Party is now beginning to build alliances with the left wing of the Lavalas movement, which is a group called Reflexion. This is a group usually of urban folks who weren't in the slums, and it involves members of the Haitian intelligentsia. And so there's some interesting sort of political dynamics that are taking place there right now. And for some reason so far, the La Tortue government, probably because they know they couldn't get away with it, the reason they didn't assassinate Aristide is they know that it would create an insurrection that would quickly boil over and they couldn't contain it at all. Right now they've got an insurrection they can't contain in Port-au-Prince, but the rest of the country is just sort of surviving without a government, which in Haiti is sometimes better than surviving with a government. But the National Popular Party does have one powerful tool, and that is they print the most widely distributed newspaper in the country. And there's an English section, they have a website, and it's called IT Progress. It's spelled Haiti Progress with one S. So it's www.haitiprogress.com. If anybody wants to sort of get a weekly update on what's going on in Haiti, and there's an English section, there's a French section, and there's a Creole section. So if any of you speak French or Creole, then you'll do better than I do a little on the Creole. On the French side, je ne parle pas. But what's important to understand is that Haiti is now in a global conjuncture that makes it possible on the bicentennial of this earth-shattering revolution of 1804 and 2004 of entering another, not reformist conjuncture, but revolutionary conjuncture. And one of the reasons, the reason that Argentinians and Brazilians and Chileans are having to perform the occupation right now is that the United States has gotten itself involved in a little bit of a problem in Mesopotamia. And they're running short on personnel. And this is true all over Latin America. If you look around Latin America right now, there's a spirit of resistance that's beginning to underwrite popular movements all over the continent. Not only do you have the Chavista revolution that's done these incredible things in Venezuela, not only do you have a 45-year-old successful insurgency in Colombia, now you've got Uruguay. Just elected a left government. You got popular organizations in Bolivia that every time they get mad, they block all the roads into the capital and shut down the capital. And they do it at the drop of a hat, you know. Ecuador overthrew a government. Argentina had a government overthrown. There's something going on. Because everybody, see, one of the reasons, and I'll switch to Iraq for a little bit, and we can come back and do a Q&A on Haiti. There were a couple of things that, let me go back. The reason I sort of aim at the military stuff is that's what I did. For 24 years, I was in the military, okay? You know that old song, I did all the dumb things? That's about me. I went to 8 conflict areas, starting in Vietnam. And re-enlisted 3 times. And each time I re-enlisted, you know what I said? I said, I swear to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic. You know, in 8 conflict areas outside the United States, I never met a single soul that was a threat to the Constitution of the United States. Not once. What I did see in 8 conflict areas was that we were collaborating with the people in the host nations in a war against poor people. I'm a slow learner. But it began to occur to me toward the end that maybe this is not accidental, maybe this is intentional. You know, maybe this is not an individual moral failure, maybe this is something that's programmed into the genetic code of the system. You know? So, you know, when we talk about, you know, we talk about how do we deal with the situation in Haiti, we got to deal with the mothership right here.
That's right.
You know? But the United States has got a little bit of trouble. Right now there's people that are beginning to rebel against them because and this gets sort of arcane, and I'm not going to go too deeply into the details of it because it's a big diversion, but at the end of the Vietnam War, we were in a lot of trouble, you know. We were broke as a nation. We were broke. France had just bought up 24% of the United States gold stocks. You know, money wasn't worth much around the world. We began to lose our power. And the rest of the world looked around and said, man, if these little brown people over in Vietnam can kick their tails, maybe all us little brown people over here can do the same thing. You know, so we had a problem. There was a failure of hegemony, and it took several years to build that back up and to restructure it. They couldn't do it the old way, the old direct gunboat diplomacy, we'll send in the troops way. They had to come up with this scheme to debt leverage the rest of the country into poverty. And that's what the World Trade Organization, the IMF, and all that stuff is about. It's a way for the United States to become an international loan shark, you know? And it's based on that system that all these other countries have now industrialized, but they don't do industrial production for internal development. They do industrial production to export to the United States to get more dollars to pay off their unpayable debts. That's some catch, that catch 22. See? Yeah, it is. It's a con. And people are getting wise to it. But it was backed up by the... There was a journalist that went to Laos one time, And he had these Laotian piastres, and he went up to one of these little roadside boutiques. He said, I need a pack of cigarettes. And the guy gave him a pack of cigarettes. He gave him the Laotian piastres, which, you know, they weren't worth anything. And the Laotian told the American journalist, said, I don't take those. I need dollars. Hey, he gave him the dollars, you know. Then a Pathet Lao guerrilla with his AK-47 came up. I need a pack of cigarettes. He gave him a pack of cigarettes. The guerrilla paid for it with Laotian piastres. And then the American was kind of miffed about that. He said, you made me pay in dollars. How come you let him pay in piastres? He said, he had the gun. Why does the rest of the world continue to allow themselves to be, you know, continue to be extorted by the? It's because the United States got the gun. Okay? It's a monetary military system of imperialism, and it's global. And it's in it here, too. If you don't believe it, we got colonies right here in the United States. What colors are those? Thank you very much. That's a nation, y'all. That's a nation. It's a colonized nation inside the borders of the United States. If you don't believe me, go look at the empirical data. Black net worth, white net worth. Ratio 1 to 14. Go look at personal debt burdens between the aggregate of black folk in this country and the aggregate of white folks in this country. Go look at the way police are perceived in white communities and black communities, and tell me we ain't got colonies inside the United States. So the United States, this system's not working very well because these people in Bolivia are closing off La Paz and all this stuff is going on. What are we going to do now? We've got to find a way to get some leverage on the world again while the world runs on oil. And so they said, let's see. 19 Saudi Arabians crashed into the World Trade Center, so we're going to go and kill 2,800 people. So we're going to go kill 4,000 innocent Afghanis. And oh, by the way, we're going to put about a dozen permanent bases in the region. And then from there, now, they said that this is because the leader, the putative leader, was in Afghanistan, who they haven't caught, by the way. The next brainstorm they get is, we're going to go to Iraq. Now, a lot of people say, you know, they just made this up because it was personal revenge. You know, he tried to kill my daddy and all that stuff. But you know what? They were writing about this stuff 10 years ago. Right. Iraq is the second biggest oil-producing nation in the world, and Iraq's not being attacked because of all the bad things that Saddam Hussein did. Because there was some stuff that they did in Iraq that was good. It was the only place in the region that had legal equality for women, that had universal free education all the way through graduate school, had universal free health care. This, in 1990, Iraq was a modern nation. And it's been systematically shattered by war and sanctions over the last 13 years. The reason they want to go in there now is to establish permanent bases because they want to be in control of the tap that controls the world's economy. That's one reason. But there's another reason. Because this is a monetary military system. They want to go in there for the demonstration effect. They were going to go in there because what did they call the first operation of the war? Shock and awe. Shock and awe. We're going to shock and awe the world with our military power. But I don't know. I'm from the South. How many folks from the South here? Y'all ever remember the story of the Tar Baby?
Yeah.
Who can tell me about what happened with the Tar Baby? Yeah, you go up there and hit it, and you can't get back out again. Iraq's Tar Baby. They didn't know what they're getting into. We're going to go in there, and everybody's going to throw roses at us like we're liberating France in 1945. And, man, instead what they got was the swarm, you know. So not only did we not demonstrate by attacking a weak and shattered nation, you know, not only did we manage to threaten the rest of the world through this shock and awe tactic, we got caught up in a situation where all of a sudden the rest of the world is now alive to the fact that the great nation bleeds. So that's the way Iraq relates to Haiti. Because, you know, people always want to talk, oh, this is a terrible thing. You know, there's a peasant out there with a gun and nobody asking the question. Why does a peasant who works with a machete need to go pick up a gun? But there's peasants in Haiti picking up guns right now. And one reason they're doing it is because they understand that when Marines have to go into Fallujah to isolate all the males and annihilate them and then convert them in the news releases into insurgents as a demonstration effect against the surrounding towns, that when the Marines have to do that and they're stretched so thin that they can't do it without bringing British troops up from Basra to cover southern Baghdad, there ain't no shock and awe left. They're strapped over there right now. You know, people say, well, you can't compare Iraq with Vietnam. Well, okay, the terrain is different. The politics is different. The history is different. There's a lot of stuff. It's different language, different culture, and yada, 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 yada. But I'll tell you about Vietnam and Iraq. In Iraq right now, they got themselves in a situation where it's politically impossible to leave, and it's militarily impossible to win. That's Vietnam. You know, that's Vietnam. And the rest of the world knows it right now. You know, so you got to be careful. Someone said, I'm afraid they're going to steal my thunder. You don't have to worry about stealing my thunder on Haiti. I start talking about Haiti, you got to slap me to shut me up. You know, because I'm in love with the place. I'm in love with that history. And I recommend people go visit Haiti. Everybody says, oh, my God, don't go to Haiti. You know, it's dangerous and it's all that other stuff. It's inspirational. It's inspirational. You know, there's a lot that's very ugly about the situation right there. But when you see this attitude, you know, Haitians refuse to bow down. They refuse to be depressed. You see what I'm saying? It's a long haul for them. You know, we used to hear, you know, all the old communist movements talk about protracted struggle. Haiti knows about protracted struggle. They've been in the same struggle 200 years. You know, there's a proverb in Haiti, and it really relates to the terrain. You got to go there, and you'll find out it's absolutely true. But it's Deye Mon Gemon, which means behind the mountain is a mountain. See, they get this. They get this. They're not in it for one lifetime. They're not in it for one lifetime. They're in the same battle right now that Dessalines was in 1803 in Crête-à-Pierre. You know, it's the same struggle. This is a nation of heroism.
How is it that Aristide didn't have any military force with which to resist the coup against him?
Aristide made a mistake, I think. And so do many of my comrades. In 1994, by allowing himself to be brought back to power in the saddle of a U.S. invasion. That's one I participated in, and that's what the book over there is about. Because Ben Dupuis, who's now the General Secretary of the National Popular Party, was Aristide's ambassador at large at the time. He warned him, don't come back in there with the U.S. troops. But he did. He came back in with the U.S. troops, and they conducted an occupation that lasted, you know, it trickled down over a period of time, but about 2.5 years. And Aristide inherited a police/military force that was very politically unreliable because it had been constituted under the de facto regime of Raoul Said Ross and Michel Francois. So Aristide decided then that he didn't need an army. All he needed was a constabulary. And so he abolished the army and put in place a 6,000-man police force, a police force that was trained as police. They had, you know, Remington 870 shotguns and revolvers as sidearms. Not in any, and were in these little outposts with anywhere from 2 to 15 people. They couldn't withstand this attack that the paramilitaries brought one step at a time against them earlier this year. Because these guys were showing up with RPGs and crew-served weapons. And I mean, you know, you just think about 3 or 4 cops any place, and all of a sudden this trained military force comes after them and concentrates this incredible firepower on them. And so, yeah, they didn't have any way. And Aristide never intended to reconstitute an army, and that was, I think, an error. The same kind of coup d'etat was attempted against Hugo Chavez last year, and the armed forces at the end of the day were there, and they were loyal to their country. They were patriots that believed in the popular sovereignty of Venezuela, and they threw that coup d'etat back in the U.S.'s face. So, I mean, that's, again, you'll get me off on a tangent about this. But it is important to understand an Aristide, and his ascent to power was part of a long, painful, and complicated process that the United States set up the elections in 1989 after Baby Doc fled before one of these popular rebellions. Well, in 1994, when the U.S. came back to invade again, the fear wasn't of the de facto government. The fear was that a popular rebellion would install a revolutionary government, so they wanted to co-opt Aristide to come back in to put his face, a populist nationalist face, on a U.S. occupation. But prior to Aristide running, Aristide wasn't going to run. So the U.S., if people go do a web search on, and put it in quotes, National Endowment for Democracy. That sounds nice, don't it? And they've renamed the School of the Americans, I don't know, the Western Hemispheric Institute for Peace and Love or something now. but I mean, you know, we know what it is. Well, that the National Endowment for Democracy is the same thing, you know. It's a wolf in sheep's clothing. And what it does, it's no covert operations outfit that was set up by Ronald Reagan's administration to go out there and interfere in other people's elections. The kind of stuff that we would call illegal here, they do all over the place as a matter of policy. And Aristide was not a candidate. The U.S. wanted to run two candidates. Now, it's real complicated about there's two ruling class factions, but the U.S. candidate was a World Bank guy named Mark Bazin. He's a technocrat. He's the perfect sort of colonial surrogate. But Mark Bazin was not very popular. So in order to make Mark Bazin popular, they went out and recruited this criminal from the Makut sector named Roger Lafontaine to be the opposition. Not because they wanted Roger Lafontaine to be in the election, because they wanted someone to make Mark Bazin look good. You see what I'm saying? So they had, you know, it was one of these, like our elections, where you got to do it. So, sorry. So, at the last minute, this small party that no one had ever heard of, the FNCD, went to this incredibly popular priest who'd been doing these local organizing initiatives all over the country for years through the Tea L'Église, the little church, because there's two Catholic churches in Haiti. There's the parish churches that tend toward liberation theology, and then there's the bishop's churches that always sort of like to snuggle up against the powerful, you know what I'm saying? And that struggle is going on too. But Aristide, you know, came out of nowhere at the last minute. He filed on the last day he was eligible to file. And the United States had no way at that point. Everything was in motion. They thought they had the fix on this thing. The people went to the polls and gave him 67% of the vote. And you know, the great Christ-like Jimmy Carter was one of the U.S. election observers that stalked out of the room in a rage, because his candidate, Mark Bazin, wasn't the guy that won. Be careful about all these, you know, so-called human rights advocates around here. We started claiming human rights when we started dropping bombs on Yugoslavs and whatnot. You see what I'm saying? So, and that charter, I was sitting there listening to that. We're in violation of every single one of those things. You know, there's only one country that's even competing with us for violating it, and that's our big ally Israel over the Middle East right now. So anyway, that's the way Aristide suddenly emerged on the scene, and it became a fait accompli, and then 8 months later they had to organize a coup. And it's not because there's big investment in Haiti. The infrastructure don't even work that. All the old assembly platform, used to be Haiti made all the baseballs in the United States, you know, and they'd make women's brassieres and electronic, all this piecework stuff. They did that in Haiti, but now you can't even get the electricity to run all day in Port-au-Prince. So they've gone someplace else where they can get people to work cheaper, like, I don't know, Indonesia or someplace. The reason to keep Haiti down, aside from continuing to point to Haiti as a failed state as proof of black incapacity for self-governance, the other reason they need that is because if Haiti gets away with it, everybody else in the region starts to get ideas. The architect of the coup d'etat this year was a guy named Roger Noriega. Roger Noriega is a member of the whole clique that sort of grew out of the Iran-Contra thing, and that clique had grown out of the old Bay of Pigs veterans group. In fact, if you take a picture of all the guys that did the Iran-Contra stuff and all the people who are in the State Department now, it's all the same guys. It's just one of these aging photos, you know? It's the same guy. You know, Roger Noriega, it's important to understand who Roger Noriega used to work for. He was an aide to a senator here in the United States. Anybody want to guess who he was? Jesse Helms. Jesse Helms, the most unrepentant racist in the whole U.S. Congress. I mean, there's plenty of racists in Congress, but there's none of them that go out there and whistle Dixie to Carol Moseley Braun in the elevator, you know what I mean? So I think the timing of this coup d'etat was designed to be a special humiliation to the Haitian people on the bicentennial of their revolution.
Mr. Goff, do you want to comment on your court-martial when you went into Haiti in 1994?
I was a member of 3rd Special Forces at the time. I still wear my Special Forces pin over here. It's not because I'm like all into militarism, but right here on the bottom of it, it's got the motto. This is a Special Forces motto, the United States Special Forces motto, covert operations motto, De oppresso liberare. To liberate the oppressed. Ironic.
Yeah, ironic.
So, me and my perennial naivete, after having gone to 7 other conflict areas and feeling ashamed of myself for what we were involved in every one of them, didn't understand the structure that I understand now. And that's why we should study. Seeing it and knowing it's wrong is not the same as understanding why and how it's wrong. See what I'm saying? But I didn't understand it then, and I thought, just once, maybe I'm going to be involved in something that's the right thing to do. It didn't take me long after I got down there to figure out that wasn't the program, but at that point, I had started to become kind of rebellious, and I was in a situation with 8 people, and I was basically the de facto military dictator of 1,000 square kilometers in northeastern Haiti, and so I was basically doing whatever I wanted to do. I arrested the guy that's running Go Naive right now, Jean Tatum, and I put him in jail. I put René Mozart, the Northeast Department's president of the FROP, in jail. I put 10 other people in jail. The FROP had shot a couple Special Forces guys, and for a little while we had a window because our commander was mad. He said, go get them. And so I started throwing people in jail, people who had used to throw everybody else in jail, which was sort of interesting to watch because it was amazing how humble they got when the door closed. But I also began to go out and do what I'd been trained to do in Special Forces for a different reason, and that was to build rapport with the local population. And building rapport with the local population, the vast majority of them meant building rapport with the committees of Lavalas. And so I made alliances with members of Lavalas, and failed to read between the lines of the mission guidance that was coming from the task force commanders, and made the other mistake of saying around members of my own team that in 24 years of military service, I'd never seen a single intelligence summary that was accurate. The intelligence summaries that we were getting were just grotesque anti-Aristide vitriol that had no relevance in terms of situation on the ground. And I became vocal about that. And the word trickled back, and members of my own team went in and turned me in for being seditious. And one day they came out in a Humvee and picked me up and drove me away. Shipped back to Fort Bragg, was taken into the Sergeant Major's office when I got back, and he said, yeah, Master Sergeant Officer, it looks like we're going to have to consider a general court-martial. And I was, you know, right on the verge of my retirement. I'd been working for I had over 20 years active duty in, and was entitled to a check that I'd worked pretty hard for. So I said, I'm fighting for my life here. And if we're going to go do a court-martial, then we're going to mud wrestle. And I sit there and gave him a list of all the violations I'd seen, not only of General Order 1, which I was accused of violating, but of attempted rapes that had been covered up, shootings that had been covered up, all kinds of malfeasance that went all the way up to the level of 06 colonels. And the next day he called me in. I wasn't Master Sergeant Goff, I was Stan. Now he said, come on in, Stan. Like everything changed, yeah, you know. He says, we think you should go ahead and submit your retirement paperwork. I said, I think so too, you know.
Comment on the relationship between Haiti
Cuba and Venezuela, since the Cubans have done a lot of good work in Haiti.
Cuba is poor because there's been this embargo. I mean, you know, a lot of stuff just can't go in there. And as poor as they are in Cuba, unlike Newark, there's one physician for every 200 people that live there. That's a pretty good deal. Yeah, you go to Haiti, there's one physician for every 5,000 people that live there. And the only place that people can go to get medical help right now are one of the 400 Cuban medical clinics that are all over Haiti right now. Onesies and twosies everywhere, and they're doing the best they can, and they don't have drugs, but it's the only medical care that's available. It's interesting, you know, that we send troops in uniforms over to other countries as a manifestation of our foreign policy, and Cuba sends doctors, nurses, and teachers. There's a lot of stuff we could learn from Cuba. You know, and maybe people wouldn't be blowing us up with IEDs if we sent some doctors and nurses over there, you know, but that's a long story. Cuba and Venezuela already have a relationship, and this is a diplomatic issue. There's no one to relate to as a chief of state right now. So, you know, who does Fidel Castro relate to in Haiti right now? Gerard Latortue? I mean, they don't even recognize him. CARICOM won't even recognize it as a legitimate government. God bless CARICOM, you know. Which, and it's not because CARICOM don't have its share of compradors and opportunists, but CARICOM is a bunch of other little black countries around there that are saying, damn, they could do that to them. They could do the same thing to us. You know what I mean? So it's been a reality check for a lot of folks up there. Venezuela's in a unique situation. Venezuela not only got away with throwing a coup d'etat back in the U.S.'s face, but we import 14% of our net oil from Venezuela. So Venezuela kind of got us by the short hair. They've got a loyal armed force, and they've got a mobilized population. These Bolivarian circles are the neatest thing since sliced bread. And, you know, they talk about them like the armed gangs. They weren't armed gangs. Anybody ever seen that documentary film, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised? It's inspiring. As a soldier who went all over the world and had people fear me, when I see those soldiers fuse with the masses like they did in Venezuela, it's incredible. That's the way it ought to be, y'all. But Venezuela is supplying Cuba with petroleum, which takes a lot of pressure off of it otherwise. And Venezuela will probably offer Haiti petroleum once they get something that looks like a legitimate government in there. Because all three of these countries have been demonized. You can read the majority of the American press, and all you get is stuff that looks like a communique from the State Department. You know? And there's a reason for that. When I was in El Salvador in 1985, I went out on a date with someone from the Chicago Tribune, and she'd been there for a long time. And I asked her, because she was telling me, she says, man, I know about all these human rights violations up in San Miguel province. I said, why don't you write about them? She said, if I wrote about that, then I would lose access to all my official contacts in the U.S. Embassy. It's not like a conspiracy. You know, it's a system. We just all integrated into it and looking out for ourselves.
How can justice, social, and peace activists help the situation in Haiti?
Right now, what they need is cash flow. 300, 400, 500, 600 individuals that give $5 a month and send it to the Haiti Support Network, care of Haiti Progress, the same website address that I gave earlier. It's at 1398 Flatbush down in Brooklyn. I don't remember the zip code. But use that address, Haiti Support Network. We need people that will commit to send $1, $2, $5 a month and keep it going. These communities of people that are up there like Maroons right now, I think right now probably about $3,000 a month. And there's quite a few people up there. It's costing about $3 to $3.50 a day for each person, because these people are fleeing from certain death in their homes. They'll be targeted and killed. All they need is some food. And when you get up in the mountains at a certain elevation, the only thing that grows up there is like coffee, banana, beans. They have to buy their rice, they have to buy their flour.